Good morning, everyone, and welcome to FutureCast. This is a regular podcast series from the Institute for the Future. Today is Thursday, December 2nd, 2010. And my name is Vivian Distler. I'm a researcher in the Health Horizons program here at the Institute. You can follow our work on Twitter. We use at IFTFHealth as our handle. Also today, if you're interested in following the conversation in a live side chat, we'll be using the hashtag FutureCast on Twitter today. Speaking of live, this call is just that. It's a live phone call, which means if you're not already on mute, I'd like to ask you to please put your phone on mute, whether it's your landline or speaker or cell phone. If you need to, you can also use *6 as a bit of functionality to put yourself on mute, and later when we get to the question and answer session, be able to take yourself back off mute. The other thing I'd like to ask is if you could please avoid putting us on hold. It turns out that many hold buttons have really distracting music playing in the background, and it kind of interferes with the conversation. I mentioned our question and answer session. Later on during the call, there'll be an opportunity for you to participate, join the conversation. When we get to that stage, if you press *1 on your phone keypad, you'll be able to enter the question queue, and there'll be a sort of mechanical voice that will let you know when it's your turn. When it is your turn, please say your name, and that way we'll all know who's speaking. Again, thank you for being a part of today's conversation. I'm very excited to welcome today several of my colleagues from the Institute, including Jer Mikowski, who will be participating a little bit later on. And we're all very pleased to have with us today our guest, Dr. Thomas Pearls, who's going to be talking to us about longevity and aging. Dr. Pearls is the founder and director of the New England Centenarians Study. Dr. Pearls, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So I'd like to start off by having you tell us a little bit about the New England Centenarians Study and how it got started.
The study has been around since about 1995. It began when I was a fellow in the Harvard Division on Aging Geriatrics Program. I was actually taking care of 40 or so patients as part of my duties as a fellow, and two of them happened to be centenarians. I'd never met a centenarian before. I had some preconceived notions about what they would be like, for example, that pretty much thought the older you get, the sicker you get, so they must have every age-related disease under the sun. And yet, these two folks who were among this cadre of patients living at the Hebrew Rehab Center for Aged in Rossendale were never in their room for me to see them. And I thought, well, maybe they're just off seeing their other doctors for their myriad of medical problems. But in fact, one was very busy playing piano for the rest of the residents at the Hebrew Rehab, and the other was a tailor, and it was always down in occupational therapy, helping mend people's clothes and teaching other people how to tailor. And when he wasn't doing that, he was robbing the cradle, dating his 85-year-old girlfriend. This really struck me as being very different than what I had expected, and I happened to be looking for a research project at the time. Found out that very little was known about centenarians, actually, and I was wondering if other centenarians were like these two, and if maybe they were suddenly some kind of model of elite aging or being able to markedly delay and escape age-related diseases.
So in your early research, and I know you published a book about some of your early research at least 10 years ago, what did you end up learning from the centenarians that you first started talking to?
So the study grew. We went out and tried to find as many centenarians as we could in what's called a population-based study, where you try and find as many of the people with the characteristic you're looking at as you can, so you get a kind of an unbiased view of what they're like. They didn't pan out to be like these two individuals who were pretty exceptional, so that maybe I'd say 20% were like that, and the other 80% had ranged from being at death's doorstep to just having mild impairment, maybe just needed a little bit of help at home. And so what we later learned that seemed to be special to us was that they markedly delayed disability well into their early to mid-90s. Some of them had diseases and even before the age of 80, we call survivors. We had people who were called delayers who had diseases after the age of 80, and then these escapers who had nothing at the age of 100. But what they did have in common is this uncanny ability to delay disability even in the presence of disease to, you know, 30, 35 years beyond the age of 60. And so we're very interested in escapers. We're very interested in how people delay disability from diseases that otherwise kill a lot of people. And that gets into this issue of resilience and reserve and what that is and what allows some people to have that and others not. We've learned that this not so much average longevity, that is getting into your 80s, runs in families, but rather this exceptional longevity very much runs in families. Families have a lot in common besides just genes. There's other factors that we know are really important to longevity, like years of education, access to health care, socioeconomic status, a number of other factors. But we've since really started to hone in on genetics, especially as we start to look at even older ages, that is 105 and older, what we call semi-supercentenarians, and from 110 and older, or what we call supercentenarians.
That's great. And so what have you been finding in terms of, I'm interested in terms of some of the, what you've learned about delaying disability and diseases. So at one time, you know, for example, heart disease seemed to be a fairly common disease of aging. I think less so now. Alzheimer's disease or dementia seem to be a fairly common disease of aging, perhaps less so now. My sense is that some of your early research actually helped us learn a lot about whether it's inevitable that our brains are going to decay with time.
Yeah, at the time that the study started, I think most neurologists and geriatricians thought that if you lived to an old enough age, Alzheimer's, which is the most common cause of dementia, was inevitable. And yet we had this cadre of subjects who were completely cognitively intact at 100, and that certainly disproved that what we call ageism or myth associated with aging or myth about aging. Now, that's not to say these people who were cognitively intact at 100, had they had the opportunity to live to 110, would not have demonstrated dementia at that point. We nonetheless actually have a number of supercentenarians who are cognitively intact as well. I think that we had also done some autopsies on these cognitively intact individuals and a bunch of other centenarians. And we have cognitively intact centenarians who had on autopsy hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, and yet they didn't demonstrate it clinically, again bringing up this issue of resilience or functional reserve. How do they get away with this burden of disease and yet not express it clinically? We don't know the answer to that.
Darn, I was just going to ask you that question.
There's a lot of interest in cognitive reserve. We've heard people talk about doing mind games, Sudoku, other cognitively stimulating activities. A wonderful expert in this field named Jakob Stern from Columbia makes this his living in terms of just studying cognitive reserve. And the question is if these games actually translate, maybe it makes you very good at that particular thing, does it translate into a broader reserve and delay or escape of age-related cognitive problems? And that's still unclear. On the other hand, I don't see the drawback in doing those things. There's now work being done with functional MRI to see if you can actually quantify this at a physiological level, and that's very exciting work. But I think we still have a long way to go to figure out how to really quantify that and perhaps translate it into something that could be put in a bottle, for example. In the meantime, go out and learn violin. or learn a new language. It certainly can't hurt, and it might actually do something good for you. We've had another few interesting findings other than the genetic. This would be, for example, we looked at personality traits in the kids being in their 70s and 80s.
And young ones.
That's right. And they score very low compared to norms in something called neuroticism, meaning that they don't dwell on things, they don't internalize things that are stressful, they're able to let go easily.
You're saying I'm in big trouble, aren't you, Dr. Pearl?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, no. It doesn't matter how good my genetics are, huh?
I think it's actually something you can modify if you are like a Woody Allen, in that it isn't so much the amount of stress a person has, it's how they manage it that is so key. These folks have personalities that are very conducive to that, but we all, I think, know what makes us feel less stressed out, whether that be physical exercise or meditation or yoga, or learning just to take a deep breath every now and then, other activities. We know what it takes. The question is, can you set aside the time and will to actually do those things?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that they tended to be, in terms of one of these personality domains, is extroverted. They and this would translate probably into the ability to develop more friendships, better social networks, social safety nets, and along with being more social, I think that's more cognitive stimulation and being more cognitively engaged, and I think that's probably a very important thing as well. Many of the centenarians will say one of the most important things for them is having a cause that gets them up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So there, and you know, we also had found some interesting things about reproduction, that the female centenarians tended to have a history of having children in their 40s. We had that as a paper in Nature titled Middle-Aged Mothers Live Longer. And it wasn't so much having a child in your 40s that was key, we think, but rather was just a marker of the reproductive system still being in fantastic shape well into their 40s. And if the reproductive system was aging very slowly and you lacked diseases that would impact upon fertility, that probably would bode very well upon on your rest of your aging well and going on to be 100. So people who had children in their women who had children in their 40s without any fertility assistance, because then that's not the marker, you had about a 4 times greater chance of living to 100 compared to those who didn't in that study.
Mm-hmm.
This may be pretty interesting to us in terms of looking at genes that impact on reproductive fitness and may also be important to aging.
Mm-hmm. So now, in your more recent research, you've been looking at whether there is at least a longevity, not a longevity gene, but a signature perhaps, a genetic signature for longevity. So you might be able to take a look and tell me whether I've got a greater likelihood of reaching a ripe old age. Is that right?
So we, over the years, had a number of publications looking at the familiality or how much this runs in families and noted that it becomes much stronger with older and older age. So even if you go from your 90s to your early 100s to 105 to 110, I think there's a growingly important role for genetic variations. Now, people do ask how much of aging or longevity is genetic and how much is environmental.
Mm-hmm.
And most people agree that to live to what we might call average longevity, or what I think most of us are capable of achieving, which is our late 80s. That is, I think most of us have the genetic and environmental exposure blueprint that should allow us to live almost 30 years beyond the age of 60. Maybe 86 for men and 89 for women. And I get those numbers from the average life expectancy of Seventh-day Adventists. And these are people who have a religion that asks you to take very good care of yourself. And generally, these folks are vegetarian. They regularly exercise. They don't smoke. They don't drink. And they do spend a lot of time with family and religion that might help them manage their stress better.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the highest average life expectancies in the country, that is 86 for men and 89 for women. they're very different when it comes to geography and ethnicity. So what really seems to impart to me this living almost 8 years longer than the rest of Americans on average are these very good health behaviors. And and so that's where we see maybe 75% or more of average longevity being environmental and behavioral. And the
I was just going to ask, I'm sorry, I was just going to ask if you're distinguishing or if you can distinguish it at all for us between behavior versus environmental, because I think
right.
environmental differently, I guess.
Well, when we think of behavior, we think about exposures that we have power over. So things like smoking and drinking and when we start talking about things like managing stress, well, then you don't know how much of the personality features and those things are genetic, but things that you can do to manage your stress would certainly be managing your behavior.
It'll be behavior, right.
Right. And environmental exposures, you know, it gets a little splitting hairs because you do have the power perhaps to change your exposure to certain toxins or pollutants and things like that, depending upon just how important you think it is to live in one place versus another. There are in utero exposures that you absolutely don't have a say over. And yes, there are things that can happen in utero. This is work by Irma Elo at the University of Pennsylvania and others who've shown that very early life exposures can have an impact upon one's ultimate longevity. These would be exposures we don't necessarily have control over, including the 100 or more years these people live on Earth and maybe oxidants and other things that could be playing a role in aging that they just can't avoid. And there's also the internal environment in terms of exposures like free radical exposures and so on. But again, how much of that is genetic and how much of that is environmental? There's a tremendous amount of gene-gene and gene-environment interaction that can muddy those waters.
And we're just beginning to learn more about the field of epigenetics.
That's right. That's right. And it's unbelievably complicated. And that is actually what then led us to this topic that you've mentioned, which is genetic signatures. Because we don't, I think it's extremely unlikely that there's going to be a single, quote, longevity gene or some very powerful gene that's going to play the determining role in these individuals that we study. And instead, I think what we're finding is this common variant, common disease kind of hypothesis where you're going to have many genetic variants with relatively weak effects that together help push a person in a particular direction, whether it be premature mortality or exceptional longevity. So, you know, there's some centenarian studies and studies of lower organisms in which they live for a few weeks or they live for a few years, as in the case of mice. There have been a few genes found that seem to play a role in the biology of aging and may help one way or the other in terms of longevity. But these discoveries have been very far and few in between. And so it was with that in mind that we thought, you know, instead of looking at one gene at a time, let's see if we can capture the simultaneous effect of a whole bunch of genetic variants that could be playing a role and see if typifying for each of these genes, a person has a variant that would be conducive to them being a centenarian or not, could help us in quantifying a genetic effect. And that is what led to this paper that we published in Science in July. And with that, I want to mention that there's controversy over this paper in that other people in the field, despite a very thorough review of the paper before its publication, had noted some of the genetic variants that we were presenting in the paper were known to be due to some faulty, what we call single nucleotide polymorphisms or faulty markers on a chip that we used for some of the subjects. These chips are made by various companies to help you quantify the genetic variations across the entire genome. So here were these faulty markers that we had no idea about, unfortunately, and neither did the reviewers, but some other scientists did. They were unpublished. And that made us go back and have to do a tremendous amount of work to come up with what we call a clean data set, where these markers, as well as some other problems that we did find with the data, had to be weeded out, and then with a clean data set, redo the analysis. Hmm. And the science did produce a letter of concern saying, yeah, there's problems with this paper. The authors and the editors are taking this very seriously, and actually we've been working nonstop, very hard, both us and an independent laboratory since basically August, have just submitted all that material now back to science. We're very pleased with the work that we've done, but now it needs to go through a thorough re-review. So I don't think people should take what we've done with a grain of salt. I actually think that the major scientific findings hold true. But again, it absolutely has to go through a re-review by the folks at science, and they need to give their blessing before anyone trusts what I've just said.
Although what I'm hearing you say, though, that is in obtaining sort of new cleaned up data sets and doing the analysis again, you're still coming to the same conclusion.
Yes.
Is that
so
right?
What were those conclusions? One was that if you take, it's not now 150 genetic markers, it's more than that. But if you take this number of genetic markers, you can, with pretty high accuracy, peg our subjects as either a centenarian or a control, that there's variations of each of these markers, which then leads to what we call a signature or a pattern that one graphically can see that for those with this really where every variant is conducive to being a centenarian, it turns out that a big proportion of our oldest subjects or supercentenarians have that signature. On the other hand, there's centenarians who don't have a signature at all conducive to exceptional longevity. And this probably means that they may belong to a family that has some very special variants that are particular to that family, and we don't have those variants on the chip. It could also be that for some people, environmental factors become very, very important. And we, of course, don't capture that because this is purely a genetic signature.
Mm-hmm.
I think that approximately, very interestingly, that up to 20% of the population, at least the control population we looked at, have signatures that give them an increased chance. Not maybe 100% chance at all. We can't predict that. But maybe even a 70% greater chance in terms of their genetics of getting to very old age. And I think that's kind of a surprise. People thought being a centenarian is very, very rare, and
right.
The chances of becoming a centenarian is very rare. But I think we're learning that many more people than we thought, have what it takes genetically to get there. Now, the question is, if you defeat that by smoking or
right.
getting very fat or doing a number of other things, very few people are going to have the genetics that can counter that kind of really bad exposure.
What about the genetics that I may have for risk of certain diseases? No, I certainly,
yeah, that's certainly the other.
And the behavioral elements of that.
That very much. I can say, again, with the proviso that the folks at Science have to re-review this, but also, a paper just came out from the Leiden Longevity Study in the Netherlands, in which they came up with very similar findings about this idea that the centenarians, to our surprise, have just as many disease variants as the general population. And so what may set them apart is not having, is not lacking disease variants, but rather having some longevity variants that might even trump or counter the effect of these disease variants.
Huh, that's great.
And so, you know, if you think about, I think this is an important consideration, and again, I'm going to rely more on the published paper from the Leiden study for now. When you hear about blood tests that say, here, we're going to discover whether or not you have a genetic variant associated with a particular disease, and then we're going to tell you what your risk is, I think that we're way too early to be able to do that, because it isn't a holistic approach. It doesn't capture what your longevity variants are that might counter if you have a disease gene or not.
I don't think we knew to think of that or look for it until now.
That's right. And do I think it's down the road that we will be able to do that? Yeah, I think these signatures are a very powerful first step in this personalized medicine. Let's look at your signatures and see what you're predisposed to, what you're not predisposed to, and then let's personalize your prevention and screening to either counter or enhance these features that we're seeing genetically. And then you did mention epigenetics. You know, let's also take into account where we can interactions with the environment and other genes as well. Well, that's what the signatures do with the genes. But I think we are heading in that direction. But I think it's right now way too early to really accurately predict whether a person is going to get a particular disease based upon what genetic variant information we have right now without taking into account these longevity variant effects.
Just out of curiosity, do you know whether the direct-to-consumer personal genomics tests like Navigenics or 23andMe are beginning to look for the longevity variants?
Well, actually, the scientists at 23andMe, as you can imagine, were incredibly interested in our paper.
Mm-hmm.
And Navigenics, which I think was associated with Decode, I might be wrong, but both these folks were very, very interested in the paper, and they were among the ones that said, whoops, we think you've got a problem and, with some of the data. And so we're actually quite appreciative that they found that, not so appreciative of how in some cases it seemed to be more adjudicated in the press than it should have been adjudicated, i.e. a letter to the editor, and then we come see if there's a problem or not, and then work it out or don't work it out. It really created quite a distracting buzz for us. But nonetheless, I think, fingers crossed, all goes well, the work will be vindicated and come out to be something that will continue to be of really tremendous interest to these companies.
It sounds like it would be. It sounds like it would be. Speaking of sort of media...
I should say that, you know, this isn't just particular to longevity. I think if you get a whiff of any genetic trait, if there's some pretty significant, you know, heritability to it, that is that it seems to run fairly strongly genetically, I think that this idea of developing these genetic signatures can be applied to a whole range of diseases, and in the case of longevity, a wonderful trait.
I was going to have applications beyond simply looking at the longevity variants.
Very, very much so. In fact, I also see it being a really helpful thing in pharmacogenomics, where we can find people who have a particular adverse reaction or a very positive outcome to a particular drug, and determine a genetic signature associated with that, and then we should be able to much better tailor who should receive what drugs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to pick up on something you had been saying a moment ago in reference to the question of how the data had been noted to perhaps be problematic in your study, and how more of that was perhaps paid attention to in the media than necessary. And contrast that with your serious approach to using rigorous scientific method to prove your work and to redo the work when it needs to be done. And take us to a related topic, perhaps, of the anti-aging medicine movement or world of science, I suppose, depending on how you or think about it.
Or science?
I'm trying to be delicate.
I've been known to not be delicate when it comes to the anti-aging industry.
Well, let's go there then. Why don't we?
Well, the two are related in terms of, I think it's very unfair to have journalists who may have a strong background in science and that they may be the science journalist or science reporter for a particular media outlet. But to then say that they have expertise perhaps in genetics to the point that they can adjudicate or mediate what critics who could be very jealous or have completely conflict of interest and a whole range of underlying reasons for why they might be attacking a study that have nothing to do with how well the study was done or what problems are done with that might be with the study. Or on the other hand, to jump to conclusions because obviously these folks, unlike the folks at the journal, unlike the reviewers who reviewed the work, don't have access to all the data. They don't have access to all the work that was done. And they may very well be jumping to unfounded conclusions and really doing the work a disservice to the point that if there's enough really terrible bias made about the work, it could really impair the ability to get the work done and have it eventually revised and have it come out the way that it needs to. Mm-hmm. So I thought a bit of that happened for us, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite distracting, I'm very hopeful that people will learn some lessons from it. And I think that journalists need to be much more careful because I don't think they are in a position to be able to say whether something was bad science or not, good science. They wanted to take the other side of the road there, because they don't have access to what they need to be able to make that judgment.
Right.
And that kind of discourse really, I think, is much, much better placed with the journal, its editors, and the reviewers that it brings in working with the authors to see what went wrong and to see what the best way is to fix it if it can be fixed, and let that process take place. Really good science cannot be done quickly, and it does take time in the lab and outside of the lab to get it done properly.
But now I can find all kinds of very credible-sounding sources that tell me that if I take supplements or hormones that I will be able to prevent or stall the aging process.
I wager you cannot find one credible person to do that.
Okay.
they may put stethoscopes around their necks and wear white coats. Their tans probably show that they're an actor and not a doctor. But, for the most part, I would say that's all quackery and scam. And I don't think you'll find one, reasonable, responsible, ethical, and moral person in our field who would go so far as to say we found something that stops and reverses aging. And
right.
That for the most part, these are people who are very interested in filling their pocketbooks. And in the case of a particular drug that I have written on in two articles that we had published in the Journal of American Medical Association, human growth hormone actually has some really bad side effects,
mm-hmm.
and is very expensive, and very interestingly doesn't stop or reverse aging. In fact, in animals that we can study it in, like mice and rats, it probably speeds up aging, makes these animals die a lot sooner who get these supplements, and they get cancer. So you say, well, why does it sell? Why are athletes taking it? It's a great name. When you use the word hormone, people immediately think of youth.
Right.
And it's just a great word.
Right.
And that,
so
and
this
then
is
you,
all
then
marketing.
You add on to that growth hormone, and oh my God, you just have a magical word. But it's just absolutely unconscionable what these people get away with. And I actually think that we're going to start seeing this go away.
Right.
People still use anabolic steroids. It does build muscle. Anabolic steroids are basically testosterone, but then they add a few things to the chemical and you get other kinds of steroids. But there are all kinds of terrible side effects with anabolic steroids as well. And I know this from reviewing medical records for the Drug Enforcement Agency from these anti-aging clinics and elsewhere, that it's an unbelievably terrible rate of bad effects from high blood pressure to heart attack and stroke and atrial fibrillation, obstructive sleep apnea. I can go on and on.
Right. So the marketing, the mass marketing of products to people who are looking for the fountain of youth, I certainly understand your criticism of
even
that.
Even at the very, you know, even something that emerged from the biological study of aging, resveratrol, I think has basically turned out to be a scam as well. That there's a whole host of those, quote, resveratrols out there that have no resveratrol in them. And even then, showing that it may help you age more slowly or other benefits, I don't think has been shown in humans at all. And it's just way too premature to see that out on the market.
And in fact, I believe one recent study showed quite the opposite. I want to ask you about other developments in science and technology that may help promote the slowing of the aging process, perhaps the reversal of aging or the ability to target specific diseases. So things like regenerative medicine or stem cell therapies or the use of nanomedicine to target diseases. Do you think that those areas of study will have an impact on the aging process?
So there's a number of things going on. One is around caloric restriction that you didn't mention. And we have seen in mice that calorically restricting them to basically the equivalent of about 1,000 calories a day in humans can make them live about 30% longer and decrease their risk for various mouse cancers. And that some of that may be actually be panning out in some primate studies as well. I guess the issue is, how do we get people to be on 1,000 calories a day? And I think for most of us, that to do that consistently is impossible.
Yeah, that was part of why I left it out, actually.
Okay. So I'm sorry. Well, I think you mentioned...
I mentioned regenerative medicine.
Right, but one of the very powerful things that's being done by people like Tom Perola and Rick Weindrick over at the University of Wisconsin is they look at genetic expression in the midst of caloric restriction, see what genes are turned on, turned off. Can you start thinking about developing a medicine that would mimic the effect of caloric restriction? And I think that's an interesting thing to be doing. And there may be some medicines there that may be not affecting aging, but perhaps one's risk for diabetes and a number of age-related diseases. There's work on telomeres. It was recently an interesting paper that came out in Science in which they toyed a bit with the gene that dictates the length of one's telomeres, which are these little caps on the end of chromosomes that keep them from unwinding. And the longer the telomere, perhaps that's also associated with being able to live longer or at least have a slower rate of aging. One of the problems with that is this very interesting interaction between cancer and aging, in that cancer loves to keep your telomeres long too, so that they can produce lots and lots of these aberrant cells that constitute tumors. So that is one of the challenges that we get into, whether it be with stem cells, nanomedicine, whatever, is when you tinker with this incredibly complicated network of genes that you're not only dealing with aging, you're dealing with cancer. And when one tries to slow down aging, you might actually be increasing your risk for cancer.
Okay.
This also happens with the hormone story that we were talking about earlier.
Right.
So
right.
It's the complexity of the system that makes this extremely challenging. And I think what we'll see in the near future of what's going to be the real payoff is prevention and screening.
Mm-hmm.
Doing these genetic signatures, there's other things going on that will help us do a better job of prediction and really pegging a person into what will work for them individually in terms of prevention and screening so that we can really markedly delay age-related diseases and diseases associated with aging, getting people closer and closer to, say, their early 90s. Do I think we're going to see people getting, you know, many more people getting to be in their early hundreds? No.
Mm-hmm.
What I really think is going to be the payoff is getting a lot more people to live almost 30 years beyond the age of 60, much of that in good function.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as we all know, the baby boomer generation is starting to age, and the number of people who are looking to live as long as possible is growing. One of the things that's, I mean, there are a number of things, I guess, that we could say that are different about this population, perhaps, than previous generations. And my colleague, Miriam Lewick-Avery, who's an anthropologist, has been studying baby boomers over the last several years. And I know she had a question she wanted to ask you about fitness and exercise. Miriam, are you on the line?
I am. Can you?
Hi, Miriam. Now that our computer has spoken to us, please join in. Miriam, you want to go ahead and ask Dr. Pearls your question?
Can you hear me?
We seem to be experiencing technical difficulties at the moment, although I did hear Miriam's voice.
Miriam, we do hear you. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, excellent. Hi. And so I was actually going to bring up an article that ran in the New York Times last week that was really, really interesting to me about a 91-year-old master's athlete who's breaking world records right and left. And one of in that area of emerging research around the regenerative effects of really hardcore exercise. And Bruce Grierson, who wrote the article, raises the question of, you know, will this cohort who has grown up in sort of a fitness revolution age differently because of that? And so I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the interaction between physical activity and physical and emotional and mental resilience and mood balancing and things like that.
Well, I think he's breaking records right and left because you're right. I think until recently, these much older individuals haven't really been enabled with the idea that, you know, there's a number of things that you can actually do to enhance your health and function. In the 80s, there was a wonderful study that came out called the Mr. Fit Study, actually conducted at the Hebrew Rehab Center for Aging at Harvard, first authored by a person named Maria Fiadaroni, exercise physiologist, who really thought, you know, that strength training doesn't have to stop in your 30s or 40s just to look buff. That, in very interestingly, the ability to build muscle from strength training does not go away. And the people that can benefit the most from that, because maybe they've gotten quite frail and have lost quite a bit of muscle, and so they have much more to gain, are these very old people. You can start off with 1 or 2 pound presses. It could be just a little bit, maybe just doing, you know, 8 or 9 reps, and that's all you can do at the beginning. But it is absolutely amazing if then done repetitively, you know, 3 times a week, you can see huge improvements in muscle bulk. And with that, you see a tremendous increase in quality of life, whether it be around, interestingly, things that you may not think have anything to do with muscle, like improved sleep, better cognitive function. But then there's also the obvious things like less falling, stronger gait, and then there's the fact that muscle is an incredibly efficient good burner of fat, and fat plays a very deleterious bad role in age-related diseases. So there's huge benefit. I think probably the most important thing we can do is strength train and build muscle. And I, as a geriatrician, interestingly, write prescriptions for people to go get with a trainer and learn how to do that on a regular basis. They don't need a prescription, but it's a nice inducement. But it's, you know, you tie that in with then seeing a bunch of centenarians that people weren't aware of before, raising the bar, thinking, wow, you know, I used to think 60 was old. Now getting to 85 isn't such a big a deal when you see these athletes in their 90s. So there's this whole social phenomenon of enablement that just wasn't there before. And the baby boomers, who have always had their cake and want to eat it too, are fairly well-to-do, well-educated bunch. And I think they're starting to see that there are some things that they can do. Not, I think people want to live longer, but they certainly don't want to do it without quality of life as well. And when we start seeing the idea the older you get, the healthier you've been, then you start saying, oh, you know, doing these things are actually worth it. It all means, I hope, a lot more people taking much better care of themselves so that they can get into their late 80s, much of that in good health.
Yeah, the whole idea of living longer and healthier, is really one of the things I found most interesting about your work with the centenarians, is that they really delayed disease, the onset of disease, until well into, you know, their last few years.
Well, they delayed disability.
Disability.
40% of them had some diseases, even stroke or heart attack, before the age of before the age of 85. It's just uncanny that they are able to deal with those diseases so much better. But you're right. Then we have these escapers, mm-hmm. and these are the ones who then go on to be 110. We have the largest study of centenarians in the world of about 2,000 people now, but also the largest study of people who live to 110 or older, now having about 115 of those individuals accumulated in the study. They do, the 110-year-olds typically are in fantastic shape at 105. So depending upon how old you eventually get to be, it puts you, you know, differently in the along that curve.
Right. We've got a couple of minutes left for a couple more questions. If you have not already pressed star 1 to put yourself in the queue for the question and answer protocol, please do so now. And I think my colleague Lynn Jeffrey has a question. Lynn? Lynn, if you are ready to ask your question, you have to take yourself off of mute, I think.
I think she just hung up by mistake.
Lynn just dropped off by mistake.
She'll be right back.
Okay. Jerry, do you have a question?
I do. That was a little bleep we heard. Was Lynn falling off the call, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, Tom, thank you so much for all your comments. This is thought-provoking in so many different ways. I had a question to ask about history, which is how has human lifespan changed over time, and has it always simply grown linearly, or are there times when we actually think that we lived a very long time to, you know, older ages, and then, you know, when hygiene dropped, our lifespans went down, and then when the hygiene revolution hit, and does it move in step functions? So is there just this natural kind of, because many different advancements help us live longer and longer, is there a natural progression, or does it go in big revolutionary functions so that the steps are big? Can you describe the, kind of the history of what we're finding?
The steps are really big, and around the 1910s, 1920s, up through the 70s. And now I think we're experiencing the point of diminishing return. And what I mean by that is, in the 1800s, average life expectancy, you know, starting around 1870, 1880, was probably around age 40 for average life expectancy. In 1900, it was 46. In Afghanistan, it's 46 now. just to put that in perspective. And then when we started to see much better public health measures, clean water supply, the understanding of public health in terms of how diseases are spread and how to prevent that from happening, then vaccinations, then suddenly we went from 46 around 1900 to an average life expectancy of 60 in 1960. And then we started to do some things like detect high blood pressure and come up with ways to treat it. Probably one of the major gaps between average life expectancy of Caucasians and African Americans until recently has been simply the inability to screen effectively African Americans for high blood pressure and treat it effectively, whereas whites were getting that. And much of the gap between the two seemed to be just some stupid screening and prevention. But then as we started to do things like screen and treat high blood pressure, do a better job of understanding what the risk factors were for heart disease, like smoking and obesity, and then have effective surgeries and some treatments for some common cancers, better antibiotics for various infectious diseases, we went from age 60 for average life expectancy at 1960 to the late 70s and the 80s, and now we're kind of approaching 81, 82, but you start to see, you get the flavor that if you graph that out, there was a very steep increase, and now it's that rate of increase is really slowing down, and you're getting an asymptotic effect where things start to as we start to reach if we start to get to what we're capable of doing, our late 80s, then we're not going to really see much of a big increase. And that's the whole idea of average life expectancy and what is pulling down the average. So we still have way too many people being obese and not exercising and smoking, and that's average life expectancy of 78, 79, almost 80. If we get a lot more people to stop eating fried Twinkies and to stop smoking and not be obese, then we're going to get a lot more people get to their late 80s.
That means they'll have to stop going to county fairs, and people don't want to do that.
Right.
There's some wonderful things about county fairs, but you're right, there's some nasty things too. Well, I think the other thing is county fairs are once a year. The key is these habits are a day-to-day thing, and people have to absolutely see that their day-to-day behaviors have a huge impact on not only how long they're going to live, but whether they're going to die in their late 70s with a tremendous amount of chronic illness and problems, or if by virtue of healthy behaviors they're going to die 15 years later than that with much less chronic disease and disability preceding their death. Now, there's the question about, did we have people who lived to be 100, 200 years ago? Probably did, maybe a very few. In part, the population was much smaller. We've had a huge population growth. So, we had 200,000 people in the United States around the time that the country was born. Now we have, you can do the math and see the huge number of people that we have that have the potential to get to very old age. The question is, and I've told you from our work, we think maybe even 20% have some genes that could get them to old age, but that's to get to 100, 105. When you start looking at super centenarians that occur 1 per 5 million in the population, and that the oldest person we've ever seen is 122, that's 1 out of 6 billion, and we haven't seen anybody come close to that in 9 or 10 years. And what I mean by close is maybe the oldest that we've seen is around 115, 116. So those folks are, you know, if somebody like Aubrey de Grey is going to say that we can get half of people today to live to be 150 and that in his lifetime somebody's going to get to 1,000, well, it won't be his lifetime, I guess, but that he thinks there's somebody around that will get to that age, I think you might as well try and build a spaceship and get them to Pluto. I mean, it's absolute nuts.
I was going to ask you about Aubrey de Grey and decided not to. I'm so glad you brought it up. Listen, we're getting close to the end of the hour, and I want to thank you for this great conversation. I'm going to ask Jerry if he'd take a couple of moments to sum up what we've heard today.
Thanks, Vivian. Sure. Actually, I need to check. Good. I did unmute myself. So we started with the question that Vivian asked about, you know, can you tell us about the New England Centenarian Study? Where did it come from? And Tom said, well, back in 1995, he was a fellow at the Harvard Division on Aging in their geriatrics program, and he had 40 patients under his care as part of his fellowship, two of whom were centenarians. And they kept doing things that really broke his preconceptions about what really old people should be doing. For one, they were never in their rooms. One of them turned out to be at the piano all the time, basically playing for everybody. And the other one had been a tailor and was still teaching people tailoring in the occupational therapy room. And when he wasn't doing that, he was busy robbing the cradle with his 85-year-old girlfriend. So this really cracked his expectations and turned him into a researcher around centenarians. And, you know, was this an elite aging cohort, or were these people somehow magically escaping age-related diseases? So some of the early lessons were trying to figure out, you know, some of the way he went about running the early lessons was to build a population-based study, so to find subjects who were actually centenarians. And they found there was quite a bit of variance. Some centenarians were at death's doorsteps, and some were actually suffering only mild impairment. And for some strange reason, many people seem to be able to delay disabilities to their mid-90s. And we had two cohorts that Dr. Pearl described here, the delayers and the escapers. The delayers seem to be getting, you know, 35 good years after age 60, and they might have had an incident of some sort around age 60, some medical problem. But the escapers seem to have no major medical issues until they were 100 years old. So this causes a lot of thinking and studies around resilience and reserves, cognitive reserves, and a lot of topics that we could go a lot deeper into. This is clearly a short call for it. But why do some people have these things and some not? And there's more than genetics going on here. So although a lot of the studies have really been focused on genetics. So there's, you know, years of education, socioeconomic status, a lot of demographic things also matter here. And then just to define two terms, semi-supercentenarians are 105 degrees and over. Supercentenarians are 110 years old and over. I think I might have said degrees a moment ago because it does look like a temperature, not an age. I'm not sure it's going to 110. It could also be a voltage. There aren't that many people who are going over into the supercentenarian realm right now. And in fact, at the end of the call, we discovered that there's almost nobody hitting 122 or so, which is the maximum recorded age. And I'll get to that in a second. But we wonder, you know, what don't these people inevitably get Alzheimer's or dementia, Vivian asked. And Tom said, well, you know, when he started with the dogma in the field was that this was just inevitable. But this cohort was significantly intact from those sorts of things. And they've done autopsies of centenarians that find that they're cognitively intact. Sometimes they have hallmarks of Alzheimer's, but no symptoms of Alzheimer's. So somehow they're holding off manifesting this clinically. And we wonder, what is this? Is it that they're playing games to keep their minds fresh? Is Sudoku? Is Will Shorts, the puzzle master, you know, actually one of the biggest scientific beneficiaries for our generations because he's keeping elderly brains fit? Or is the Wii Fit, you know, fitness and exercise really benefiting here? Jacob Stern did a study at Columbia where he was looking at cognitive reserve, and he was trying to figure out, do these people have a broader reserve? There's also been now a lot of fMRI studies, functional magnetic resonance imaging, trying to figure out, can we quantify these things physiologically? And, you know, Tom's advice to us is go learn the violin learn a new language. Do something that will actually involve your brain. So there's lots of other findings. For example, there are personality traits in the kids, and here kids is people aged 70 to 80. And the kids tend to score low on neuroticism. They can let go of things. They let go of stress. They let go of all sorts of things that might otherwise cripple them. How you manage stress, it's not so much that it's the amount of stress, but how you manage stress that makes a difference, so finding what works for you. The kids were also extroverts. They had more friendships. They had more social networks. They had more safety networks when things happened. They had more cognitive engagement with other people. They also seemed to have a cause that got them up in the morning. That was really important. One small side issue was that women who had born children in their 40s, that seemed to be a marker of good reproductive system aging, which might be a marker of good aging in general. So those women seemed to have a four times higher likelihood of actually living to considerable age. Then we talked a bit about, you know, is there a genetic signature for longevity? And we started talking about the difference between a gene for longevity, like the death gene or whatever else you want to call it, and signatures, which are combinations of genetic markers. And so we talked also about the difference between, you know, what's the balance between genes and the environment here. And in the late 80s seem achievable for us all today, that the general life expectancy is a little bit above 80. But Dr. Pearls has looked at a lot of data from Seventh-day Adventists, who, because of their religious holdings, are vegetarians, non-smokers, exercisers, really have very good health habits. Their average life expectancy tends to be 86 for men and 89 for women. They live 8 years longer than the average American, for example, out of these good health behaviors. So it seems to say that there's a lot of environmental things or behavioral things we can change. And Vivian said, what's the difference between behavior and environment again? Well, behavior is a lot of the things you can control, things like whether you smoke or not, drink a lot, eat a lot, so obesity and so forth, and stress. And environment is even things that grow back in utero. So they're discovering, Irma Ilo at 10 is discovering that early life exposure can even affect longevity. Then we entered the conversation a bit about epigenetics and talking about how these signatures really work. It's not one gene, it's combinations. And there's some very interesting studies going on today. But the discoveries in this field there's discoveries about genes and what genes might contribute to longevity, but the discoveries are few and far between. So the researchers have started moving over toward finding patterns. So Dr. Pearls and his colleagues just published a paper in Science in July, which turned out to be somewhat controversial because some of the polymorphisms might be due to a faulty chip that was used to actually collect the data. So they went back, and we talked for a while about the study and going back and perfecting the data and resubmitting it. And that also took us into some conversation about the media and the media's response to the study and the controversy and how the media tends to see itself as sort of judge and jury and isn't really helping the process. And Dr. Pearls says, you know, peer-reviewed journals work pretty well. The scientific process works really well. It takes a little bit of time, but if you let it happen, things like this get straightened out over time. So in these studies, they found that there were sort of more than 150 genetic markers that can peg centenarians and separate them from the control group, but there were some centenarians who maybe had no markers at all. So then you wondered, was it some other aspect, or was it environmental factors that were outweighing family factors or heredity in those cases? So it turns out also that up to 20% of your average population has these signatures, has these markers, so it could potentially live to a very old age. Vivian asked about risks for disease, and Tom answered, well, there's a new paper out of Netherlands, a longevity study there. They found a surprise, which was that centenarians have just as many disease variants as the average population, but it might be that the longevity variants may outweigh those particular markers. So it's too early to be able to tell. It's too early to be able to head toward probabilistic medicine from these analyses, but you can see a future where we might be able to personalize interventions. Vivian asked about Navigenics, 23andMe, and other companies that are trying to help people see their markers, and I actually just had the 23andMe study done myself. And 23andMe was incredibly interested in the data that Dr. Pearls and his colleagues came up with, and in fact helped start to point out some of the data problems in the study. But there's, you know, also interesting things here about heritability, and the signatures that that he's been finding in these studies may in fact apply to more diseases, that may be much broader applicability to these findings. So then we talked a bit about quackery and scams and so forth in supplements and the industry of trying to help people live longer, which dates back at least to the search for El Dorado and probably way before that. And Dr. Pearl says, look, there's probably not one credible scientist who's actually putting their name behind these things. It's really lots of quackery and scam. And in some cases, like HGH, human growth hormone, there are some bad side effects. It isn't proven to stop aging, it sometimes speeds aging along, but it sounds like youth. Anabolic steroids are in use a lot, and he's seen some terrible, terrible side effects from those from studying DEA medical records out of that. So Vivian then asked about other theories like regenerative medicine, stem cells, and nanotechnology. Are they promising? And Dr. Pearls went to caloric restriction diets first, saying that really does seem to work. It just seems to be impossible to implement in humans. So How can we really do that? There's a study being done by Prola and Weinrich about genetic expression and caloric restrictions, so that maybe there's a way to emulate this through therapies of different kinds, so that you don't actually have to do the full caloric restriction diet, but you get the benefits of it in longevity. There's also work being done on telomeres. There's another paper in Science that recently came out, and telomeres are the caps on the end of chromosomes that tend to keep the chromosomes from fraying and breaking and then not being able to replicate anymore. Interestingly, cancer loves long telomeres too. Cancer wants your cells to replicate wildly out of control and not die as they do so. So there's a lot of interesting inter-effects here, and the complexity is what makes this all really challenging. So in the future, prevention and screening is probably going to lead to a lot of really good things, as it has pretty much recently. And it seems that a lot of people will be able to have many more years beyond age 60 in good function, in good physical function. Miriam jumped in and asked a question about, there was an article recently about a 91-year-old master athlete and what he had done and the regenerative effects of hardcore exercise, because it turns out that, well, as we get older, we think, well, exercise won't do us any good, maybe we stop doing it. And her question also is, did the fitness revolution, did this generation that is growing up in the fitness revolution and takes hard exercise for granted, will they age better? And, you know, does that affect also emotional and mood and other kinds of factors? And Dr. Pearl said, well, until recently, older people didn't really go for big exercise. And in the 80s, there was a study, the Mr. Fit study at Harvard by Maria Fiadaroni, that said that, you know, the ability to bind muscle, to build muscle tissue, doesn't go away with age, which is good news for people like me who are trying to figure that out as well. And the biggest benefit seems to be for the oldest people. So even if they start very, very small, if they lift, you know, a one-pound weight 8 times and that's all they can do and they're exhausted, that can still really play out in good ways. So there's sometimes amazing results for very, very old people and amazing results in their quality of living. So it seems like, you know, people, delaying the onset of disease is a big deal. It turns out that 40% of the people this is Vivian talking, that 40% of the people had major incidents by age 85, but that they're changing for the better. So there's a lot of people who, for the super centenarians, it turns out that in the sample that Dr. Pearls and his staff have, there are 115 people in the super centenarian category. Most of them were in fantastic shape at age 105. So they got to age 105 having delayed the onset of a lot of different sorts of things. I then asked a question about the history of aging. What does it look like? Does it just sort of, is it a slow slog, a slow progression that just gets better? Were there epochs when we were when we had good longevity long ago? And Dr. Pearl says, well, the steps are really big. This is step functions over time. So now we're in some sort of diminishing returns process. And he pointed out that back around 1870, 1880, the average life expectancy was probably 40. That jumped up to about 46 in 1900, which, by the way, is the same as today's life expectancy in Afghanistan, a place where you don't have a lot of the benefits of hygiene and so forth. Then by 1960, it had jumped up to about 60 because of vaccinations, hygienes, and also screening. We started screening for things like high blood pressure, what Dr. Pearls called stupid screening and prevention, the simple stuff. It's a little bit like Atul Gawande's emphasis on washing hands and making sure that compliance happens everywhere. And then we moved up to about 81 in the 1980s, where we started understanding risk factors and starting trying to convince people to stop smoking, lose weight, and also finding better treatments for different kinds of cancers and so forth, and helping, you know, convince people to not go to the county fair and eat that deep-fried Twinkie or the deep-fried everything. It seems like everything at county fairs is deep-fried these days. So one thing that might be happening is that people will be able to die later without chronic conditions, because people with bad habits tend to have very costly and very troubling chronic conditions that hit them late in life that make the last years of the life really not very pleasant. Then he said, well, is it possible that there were centenarians long ago? Well, one really important thing to note is that there were very many fewer people on this planet long ago. So, you know, in 1776, how many Americans were there? Not that many. And he points out that a super centenarian, so aging age 110, is a 1 in 5 million occurrence. And if you don't have that many millions on Earth, you're not going to have that many of them. And the maximum age, of 122, one person seems to have hit that in 6 billion people on Earth so far. Now, this is all about record keeping and all sorts of other sorts of things, so we don't know. And but nobody seems to have come close to that in the last 9 or 10 years. We haven't been hitting that 122 mark. So we talked briefly at the end of the call about Aubrey de Grey, who seems to believe that half the people living today can successfully live to at least 150, and that one or several of them might actually hit 1,000 years of age, that we'll be able to conquer some of the things that actually kill us off, and a few people may make it to extreme longevity. And I think Dr. Pearls is a little bit skeptical about that. Vivian, back to you.
Thank you, Jerry, for that terrific summary of the conversation, and certainly gives us a sense of how rich our conversation has been today with Dr. Pearls. Dr. Thomas Pearls, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. It's been a really interesting conversation. I look forward to having a chance to talk to you again. Thank you for sharing with us your research and understanding of longevity and the future of aging on this FutureCast call. Today, again, is Thursday, December 2nd, 2010, and it's been great having everybody participate. Please feel free to have to tell others about these calls and also to let us know what we can do to make them better. For the Institute for the Future, I'm Vivian Distler, and we'll talk to you again soon on our next FutureCast call. Goodbye.